Okay, let me check my watch here. And, yep, there goes another change implemented by the NFL. It seems to be coming down the pike every couple hours. I think they're implementing more changes than the New England Patriots' deflated balls. Is it weird to laugh at your own jokes even when they're not that funny? It's Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Happy Thursday to you. Friday Eve. Yes, wherever you are in the world, our thoughts are going out to Brussels. Really hope they catch us surviving terrorists so we can put him to death somewhere, somehow. America and the world should vote on this. Obviously, Brussels should get the most say. Anyway, keeping in a very positive mode, we have a great show coming your way. We have an international model on our show today from Hawaii. We're going to be waking her up. We're going to give her a few more minutes of shut-eye. So, you know, in the morning, when it's 5 o'clock in the morning, like 5 minutes is like an hour. It's like gold to sleep. So, but this model is a with a disability that has propelled herself to be like front and center for the world to see. And we really have a lot to learn from her because her message is so strong and she's so devoted to everything she's done. And she's teamed up with different organizations. And we're going to hear her incredible story in just a few minutes. I'd like to share a story with you, if that's okay with you. Well, it's not like I can't hear you say no or shake your head. But you can call in, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Just ask for Jose. There's no Jose here. You can ask for Jesse. Jesse's our producer here, and Jason Taubenfeld, our program director extraordinaire. And we thank God that Jason's back to his 100% self. He had some surgery there, breast augmentation. No, not breast augmentation. He had some, you know, some work done. And he looks 20 years younger. Unbelievable. Yeah. So anyway, the other day I spoke at a school for fourth and fifth graders. And nothing new right there. But for two reasons I want to bring this up to you. Because this school in particular, they were such incredible listeners. They were so, I guess this pays kind of a compliment to myself, hanging on every word I said. And for fourth and fifth graders, 250 to 300... to be sitting on a gymnasium floor for that long, to be totally paying attention, focused. I mean, I'm walking around, I could see their eyes and their heads. I never, usually once or twice during an hour or 45-minute session for that age group up to like fifth grade, you usually have to say once in a while, like, hey guys, okay guys, bring it down, you know, because that's their attention span. But they were incredibly focused. So I think it's a true testament to what kind of work the administration and teachers are doing there. As a matter of fact, I sat next to, before a talk, I like to walk around and nobody knows who I am. They know, obviously, I don't belong there. I'm obviously new. So I shake some kids' hands and find some kids. If there are any kids with apparent disabilities, you know, say hello to them, you know, introduce myself, make everyone feel comfortable. Say like, hey, do you know who's speaking today? Oh, that guy, Mark, he doesn't know what he's talking about. I can't believe they brought him in today. So anyway, there were a bunch of teachers sitting there on chairs, and so I sat next to them. We're talking, you know, get a feel of like, you know, how the temperature of the school, if there's bullying going on. Fourth and fifth grades, a little young, really starts around sixth grade. Fifth, sixth, and seventh, very prevalent. Anyway, I said to one of the teachers, and actually a crowd of like three or four, I said, hey, thank you for what you do. And they looked at me, and they're like, whoa, thank you. Wow, no one's ever said that to me. I said, you must be kidding me. No one's ever thanked you for being a teacher? They said, no. I said, that's really a sad statement. She said, well, we think so too. I said, but really, I mean, they have a really hard job. I know teachers kind of get some flack because of their pay and the amount of time they work, et cetera. But it is a hard job. Imagine, you know, having a classroom full of people. You know, you can imagine this. I don't need to go into detail. It's difficult. And to keep focused and to keep very positive. And, you know, you're molding minds, especially that young. I mean, you have such a major influence on kids in third, fourth, fifth grade, you know, even first and second. My Lord, you know, has a pivotal outcome on who these kids can be. So I wanted to bring this up because they were good listeners. But more importantly, when I asked for question period, it was the last 15 minutes I usually give to Q&A. One girl stood up and she said, I have a disability, I have epilepsy, but I want to ask you about one of my friends who's not here. Again, now this girl is either in fourth or fifth grade. I was so awestruck that, number one, she had the wherewithal to stand up at that young age in front of all her peers and articulate that she has epilepsy. That is so cool. I think I stopped her at that point and said, I want to congratulate you on just being very, very comfortable with who you are and sharing it with everybody. And that's really neat. As a matter of fact, one of the ways I start different talks have different intros. But for this one, for young kids, I run in after they introduce me. I run into the gymnasium. I'm like, hey, you know, I forget their mascot's name. I think it's Bobcats. Hey, Bobcats, how you feeling? They're like, yeah. And they're kind of quiet. I'm like, listen, this is the one time you're allowed to scream your head off. Come on, Bobcats. And they're like freaking out. Then I'm like, okay, great. Raise your hand if you are totally stoked to have next week off for spring break. And they'll raise their hands, freaking out. I'm like, okay, raise your hands if you like going to the movies and having ice. Oh, they're raising their hands. They love ice cream. They love movies. Okay, now listen up. Raise your hands if you like being different. And about 3/4 of the kids raise their hands. And at this age, you wonder, is it just following the crowd, just putting their hands up, or because they put their hands up for the first two questions. And so I went up to 2 or 3 of them. They said, no, I like being different. And they followed it up with a very, very rational reason. It wasn't because, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to raise my hand. But I was really, really surprised and impressed. And I think it's because, obviously, parents are doing hopefully a good job at home in combination with teachers. And teachers and parents can't do, if one of them are doing a great job, it's not going to have the same impact as if they're having the reinforcement at home or in school. Things have to work in tandem. And it's great. So this girl goes on to say, yes, I have a disability. But more importantly, my friend has a condition. I forget the name of it. I'm sorry. I'm remiss at thinking of this name right now. But it's a condition where you can't be around loud noises. Her skin can't be exposed, etc. So she could not be actually in the presentation, my talk. And I'm surprised, actually, after I left, because I was getting some thought on the ride home, that they couldn't give her headphones or maybe have an interpreter or some accommodation. So I was actually interested in following up with the principal. And or if she has any questions for me, you know, I always say to counselors, if anyone has any questions for me, you know, I don't want anyone contacting me directly, because when they're below 18, I don't want any misperception of anything that's not, you know, on the up and up. So I don't have any students contact me directly under age 18. College and above, sure, you can contact me. But if someone wants to call me, I want them to be in the guidance counselor's office with them on speakerphone, et cetera. So there's always another adult present, a third person, because I just think it's a very safe thing to do. Keeps everything, you know, there's no subject to any impropriety or anything of that nature. So she goes on to ask questions about if she's doing all that she can do for her friend. Wow. I'm blown away. Number one, she blew me away with her candor of standing up in front of her peers saying that she has a disability. And then she is so considerate and sensitive, empathetic to her friend who could not even be in the room due to her disability, that she's even asking questions if she is doing enough as her friend. Wow, that says so much to the core of someone. And then at that age, that is just stupendous on so many levels. Isn't that? I mean, think about that. If you were in 4th or 5th grade, can you imagine yourself standing up and saying, I couldn't imagine myself back then saying, yeah, I'm visually impaired. People probably would be like, what's that? Well, that's because I carry around this big ass dictionary from the New Jersey Commission for the Blind and Visually Impaired. That's 11.5 pounds. Yeah, that's why you noticed why I was carrying that book around. But I couldn't imagine doing that. Could you imagine? Even standing up, sometimes I remember even being in class, being so nervous at a young age, having to read like a paragraph or a passage because, you know, I couldn't see it that well. And I'd be like, oh, my God, they're going to call on me. Oh, they called on me. Don't screw up, Mark. Don't screw this up. So it's kind of crazy, right? But it's kind of a testament, because I think this industry, they're not millennials. But I would say that I think our future generations are going to be, and I see this now sometimes, so much more articulate, because at such a younger age, they are using digital devices and it requires them to read. So I think possibly their verbal skills. Now, this could be contradicted because sometimes when you do use, you know, digital platforms for other purposes, it does take away from the social interaction. Yes and no. I guess it depends on a platform. But I find kids being much more open and candid and articulate. And that's great. Maybe it's because we're the warm, fuzzy, in touch with our feelings kind of generation now, overall, the nation. You know, as I just kind of alluded to, the NFL, you know, getting more rules in place, you know, in terms of special teams, you get two personal fouls, you're kicked out of the game, like all these different things are changing. And that's changing for different reasons. But the reality is there's so much more science that is aware, that is, you know, hardcore black and white science that are making people aware of things in life. And now we're obviously a more informed society, I should say, in the workplace, how we need to be treated. And yes, sometimes all this goes a little bit too far, but sometimes it has to go too far to get to the proper happy medium. Does that make sense? I think so. So back to my point for kids, I think possibly, and again, this goes hand in hand with parents and what their home communication life is like. And myself and my wife do our best to, you know, very openly communicate, you know, within reason. Certainly kids don't need to know, like if the Brussels bombing was on the other day, and I shut that off right away. But if my kid asked me what happened, you know, I'll say to him, you know, there are some people in this world, as I've told you before, that aren't that nice. And that's why there are jails. And that's why our government has courts and laws to properly channel these people. And, you know, he gets it. And it's too young. You don't want to fill kids' heads with hatred or understanding too much of what ugliness there is in this world. But you know what? It's a constant reminder that when you see how much ugliness there is in this world, there are so many people out there doing incredible things for other people, for humanity. And it's sometimes we get, I don't know, disillusioned. It's very easy to get disillusioned. Disillusioned. Have another drink. Disillusioned. Because there's just sometimes there's so much hate and ugliness, you know? Donald Trump. I'm not going to get political, but I'm just saying Donald Trump, in terms of, you know, what he spews, you know, he brings out, you know, anger in people in terms of how he speaks and how he articulates, or lack of articulation sometimes, of what's wrong with this country. And I know it's certainly inflated. Yes, every country has a lot of issues and public and policy concerns and changes in our Congress, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm getting off point here a bit. But the reality is, you know, things are pretty good. It can be much, much worse, especially for the Tennis Association, if you're Raymond Moore. Did you hear about this? Oh, my Lord. Talk about putting your foot in your mouth. This guy's a CEO, puts his foot and racket, as in tennis racket, in his mouth. The other day, Raymond Moore, he's a CEO and tournament director, or I should say former tournament director of the BNP Paribas Open at Indian Wells, California, said that Women's Tennis Association players ride on the coattails of men. As a matter of fact, instead of me saying this, let's hear the audio clip.
No, I think the WTA, you know, if in my next life when I come back, I want to be someone in the WTA, because they ride on the coattails of the men. They don't make any decision, then they're lucky. They're very, very lucky. If I was a lady player, I'd go down every night on my knees and thank God that a Roger Federer and a Rafa Nadal were born, because they've carried the sport. They have a lot of very attractive players. And I mean, the standard in ladies' tennis has improved unbelievably. And if you go out...
Do you mean physically attractive or competitively attractive?
No. I don't. I mean both. Both. You know, they are physically attractive and competitively attractive. They can assume the mantle of leadership once Serena decides to stop. I think they have quite a few very, very attractive players.
Okay, so bye-bye Mr. Moore, because as of Tuesday evening, over his disparaging remarks that he made on Sunday about women's tennis players, he resigned. Well, that was a no-brainer. What a sexist, outdated man he is. I mean, come on. All right, you may think these thoughts, but don't articulate these during a press conference? I mean, why would you host an event such of this caliber? I mean, I get it. Okay, you're maybe 60, 70 years old. You come from a different generation. But you got to open your eyes, pal. Look at the world we live in. We are open nation, forgiving. We want, when we could possibly have a female president, Hillary Rodham Clinton, next year. And you're making a statement about women tennis players? Are you kidding me? So, of course, the comments provoked criticism from, you know, a whole slew of people. And, of course, Serena Williams was actually part of that tournament. And so she said, I think those remarks are very much mistaken and very, very, very inaccurate. And Billie Jean King went on and tweeted that Moore is wrong on so many levels. And the ATP and WTA tours also weighed in with public condemnations, also rebuked by Martina Navratilova, and the WNBA expressed solidarity too. Of course, how could I not? As a matter of fact, I was watching a clip of Serena, and you know, that, and she said some things that have been in the spotlight in the last year, year and a half. And, you know, I think she's a good, a great, phenomenal tennis player, maybe the one of the best female players of all time. And I think it's very, very difficult, no matter who you are, when you're in a public eye, to always say the right thing, always. And, you know, when you do a tennis tournament of this caliber, of any caliber, you have to participate in press conferences. So you can tell she was choosing her words extremely carefully. She was speaking slower than usual, and you know she just wanted to go crazy and rip this guy a new one. But she realized that, hey, you know what? I'm not going to stoop to that level. I'm going to take the high road, et cetera. And maybe she was just too tired from practicing anyway. So Percocet, anybody? Any takers for some Percocet? Yeah, sure. Well, you ever hear of like too little, too late? I think this is a lot little, way too late. But on Tuesday, the FDA rolled out new warning labels to help fight the rise in prescription painkiller addictions. Wow. It's 2016. They're just getting wind of this? So the FDA says this problem has reached epidemic levels, epidemic levels. Where have you been, FDA? Are you kidding me? Are you just coming out of a coma? And the first thing that needs to change, they say, is physicians overprescribing the opioids. Hello, FDA, wake up. This is your wake-up call, a.k.a. the fun pain medications like, let me see, morphine. I'm omitting in my medicine cabinet in my mind, oxycodone, codeine, et cetera, all these drugs. You know, like the pharma parties that kids have where they just open up, they take out their parents' salad bowl and they just throw in all these medications. Yeah. So these drugs put people at high risk of addiction. No kidding, FDA. Overdose. No kidding. And even death. Yes. Proven. So the FDA is pushing doctors to start with other treatments or lower doses. Good idea. Wicked, wicked late. Percocet. Unbelievable. I don't know what to say about that. As somebody who, when I was in school, high school and college, who didn't really have pharmaceuticals at my disposal, I probably would have imbibed. Certainly because it's so easy in terms of, hey, you take a pill, you feel this. All I did was mushrooms that were in terms of, you can't, those obviously are natural organisms. But anyway, FDA, way too little, too late. But I mean, it's not too little. Obviously, any move in the right direction is a positive move, and that's a great thing. In a few minutes, again, I mentioned this in the beginning of the show, we're going to meet Shahali Ayers. She's an international print and runway model, graphic designer, and a disability advocate, and she's going to be calling in from Hawaii, and we look forward to that in just a few minutes. We're going to give her a few minutes of shut-eye, and then we'll meet her. So from the How Cool Is This files, beeping Easter eggs. Can you imagine being visually impaired or blind all your life? And so when Easter comes around, you're like, oh, cool, candy. Great. But I don't kind of get to take part in the Easter egg hunt because, well, maybe you could if you're a parent and you play hot and cold with the kids and you kind of have to put the Easter eggs in kind of a obvious place so they can find them. But no more. This is pretty cool. A Florida bomb. That's right. A Florida bomb disposal squad created beeping Easter eggs. So very cool. That's why it's part of the How Cool Is This files. For visually impaired kids, eggs with special beepers. They don't blow up. They just beep so that visually impaired kids can still look for Easter eggs even if they can't see them, which is the part of the whole reason why they're doing it. So now kids, I guess, I don't know if they're remote control or the bomb squad goes out there. It still seems weird to have bomb squad with eggs and sending little kids out. Okay, look for the landmines. I mean bombs. I mean Easter eggs. And they're colored. They're ticking or beeping, but they're fine. And you can eat them afterwards or they have stuff inside. So very, very cool. I mean, these kids must have a blast. I mean, I would have fun with like a beeping Easter egg. So kind of the heartbreaker of this story, which is really neat, was a couple years ago when one of the egg hunters was partaking, the difference between him and the other egg hunters was that he was 75 years of age. And it was his first time in his life that he was involved in an Easter egg hunt. Blind, and this is the first time he was able to obviously use his ears to find the eggs. And I think that's really, really cool. I mean, I did that stuff when I was a kid, and it's kind of cool, but you don't, I guess, can think about it too much because you take it for granted. But that's really, really neat. So big hats off to the Florida Bomb Disposal Squad. I think they're in I forget what part of Florida they're in, but that's very, very cool. If you want to Google that, I'm sure you could. Now, our next story I want to bring to you before we meet Shahali is about a woman in Minnesota. She wrote a heartbreaking, honest obituary for her 31-year-old sister who committed suicide a few months ago, I think in the month of February. And I bring this story for a few reasons. Because, number one, I think it's on point for two reasons. Number one, it's all about the dark, taboo word suicide. I'm very familiar with it for the Insight listeners who regularly listen to the show. You know, my brother took his life at age 40. That was 24 years ago. I went through my own depression and panic attacks and anxiety. So it's pretty near and dear, close to my heart, and very involved with organizations, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, et cetera. Help people out, take part. As a matter of fact, in New York City, there is a walk in June, on June 4th, called Out of the Darkness, which we're going to have a show on that in the next couple of weeks. It's basically a walk to raise money for education, prevention, and research. But basically, it's really cool. Happens in New York City here. It starts at dusk and goes to dawn. It's a 16-mile walk. That's right, 1-6. And actually, the previous walks were 24 miles or 26 miles that I've taken part in. So I guess just for logistics-wise, it's 16 miles, and it's the most amazing thing you can take part of because you can just walk it and do your own thing and wear headphones and be part of a cool movement. You can meet a lot of people, hear a lot of stories, share a lot of stories. It's really, really heartwarming. My wife and I are going to do it. Really looking forward to it. So getting back to my point here, that there's a woman who she lost her sister, and she had two choices. She could, I guess, write an obituary saying, you know, how much she loved her sister and how beloved she was and what a great person she was. And that would have been fine because that's what most obituaries are. Or served some platitudes up nicely. But she chose a different route. She said, quote, "My sister was the kindest, most awesome person you will ever meet who advocated for everyone but herself. My sister was lied to by her depression," she said. Such an accurate and true line. I'm going to read that again. Her sister was lied to by her depression. She actually wrote my sister. My sister was lied to by her depression. So the sister who died, her name was Aletha. So when Aletha tragically took her own life, she felt she couldn't write her sister's own obituary that didn't feel true to who she was. And Pino is the surviving sister. So Pino had written that. And she continued to write that it seems the only reason depression and suicide are so pervasive problems is because we don't know how to talk about them, which is so very true. We know this time and time again. As a matter of fact, in Sarrahville, New Jersey, a police officer who was touted as a hero took his own life in a car the other day, earlier this week. Again, no one knew. Very common story here. No one knew he was depressed, if he was suffering, etc. But unfortunately, this young officer, a detective, wife, and I believe two kids, could not raise his hand and say, "Listen, I need help." And this is all too common for officers, people of positions of power, where they feel that it shows a sign of weakness. If you carry a gun, a badge, wear Kevlar, anything of that nature in the military, that you're perceived as weak if you have any mental illness. The associations, Policemen's Association, PBA, people have come out and said that, you know, we really try to advocate for this, but it's still very, very rampant. Anyway, so we continue to go on with this stigma of suicide. And the surviving sister said, if the family were to have a big pie-in-the-sky dream, we would ask for a community-wide discussion about mental health and to pull the suffocating demon of depression and suicide into the bright light of day. Really well put there. So she says, please help us break the destructive silence and stigma surrounding mental illness and suicide. Pino goes on to say, I don't care what people think about me or my sister. I love her. I loved her and will always love her. She said, Pino added that she hopes to keep doing advocacy, work in mental health in her sister's honor. And this is the last thing I can do for my sister, she said. So I think it's great. I take my hat off to her because she's very honest. I mean, when my brother died, we didn't not tell people that he took his life because, first of all, I don't know. I mean, we were in such shock. How could you even have the clarity to even concoct a story? I guess people do, and they're embarrassed, and I guess it depends on what kind of family, the nucleus of your family, and what kind of truth system you had in place. But I understand how certain cultures cannot be honest about suicide, but it's just a shame that that's the case. But I do really take my hat off to her for being so honest and forthcoming. And it must have been so hard for her to write that obituary. Cathartic, though. Very cathartic, because I'm sure that when she was writing this, she felt like she was not just writing something, you know, the 30 lines or so that was permitted in the local newspaper or online, the digital edition, to talk about her sister. Her sister's, you know, character and soul, memory will always live on. But in terms of helping others, you know, if she said that her sister helped everyone else in this world but failed to help herself, then maybe her sister felt it was her duty to help other people and to help her sister's legacy by helping other people through being very candid in her obituary. So hopefully we're not to deal with things of that nature for too long. Organizations like American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and more are out there doing great work. And we're going to have a member, a representative on there, Bob. I just forgot Bob's last name. The executive director from there, we're going to have on a medical doctor. So we'll talk about that walk in New York City, which happens on June 4th. If you're interested in that, you can Google Out of the Darkness, or I think it's, I'm sorry, yeah, OOD, Out of the Darkness, yes, or overnight.org, and it's a great way to see New York City. So I spoke to you a few times earlier this morning about a person I'm very, very interested in, looking forward to having you meet. Shahali Ayres is an international print and runway model, graphic designer, disability advocate, and a person with a disability that is really just propelling herself forward to really change how the world perceives people with disabilities. You know, I'm all about that, as you know. I mean, this is what I do when I'm not on the microphone here at Progressive Radio Network. And by the way, we're always taking your calls, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. But it's what I do when I'm not at the microphone here. I'm on stages talking about overcoming adversity, being born with a very rare visual impairment, and being very vocal about it. How it's impacted my life on so many different levels. I wouldn't be the same person that I was if I didn't have this. And Shahali feels the same way. It's my pleasure to welcome Shahali to the show. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Rather, I should
great
say
to be on the show.
Aloha.
Aloha.
I can't even ask you if it's a nice day because the sun hasn't risen yet, has it?
No, it hasn't. I'm looking out the window right now.
Okay, well, thank you for being such a good sport about getting so early, up early at 5 o'clock in the morning your time, and we greatly appreciate it. And first question I have for you is you were born in Florida, but I guess your parents didn't want to stay there, so they took you to Oregon?
Yes, that's correct. I grew up in Oregon.
So what was it like growing up in Oregon with a disability, a congenital birth disability, where your arm, I believe just below your elbow, is missing?
Yeah, that's right. Well, me, I grew up in a small town in Oregon, so I think I was the only person with a visible disability, and my town was really small, and the school was really small, so I stood out. And I think because of that, you know, I had to deal with a lot of adversity. You know, it was a challenge for a lot of people to see someone that was different, so different from them. So with that, you know, there was, I guess I dealt with a lot of bullying growing up. So there's that.
I would think in a small town it could go either way. They could embrace you because, you know, it could be very family-oriented, almost like Mayberry. Like, or it could be like very, very uncomfortable because you walk into the diner and it's like, oh, you can feel the looks and you can read the bubbles over people's heads. So obviously it wasn't the favorable aspect.
Well, it didn't help that we moved quite a lot. So we went from like little town to little town. So after I was established and people got to know me, I was like, okay, time to move again. So I went through that over and over and over again.
So tell me about when you were small. You have two brothers. Your parents treated you like any other kid?
Yeah. The funny thing is I didn't even know that I was disabled until around first grade because my parents did treat me just like anybody else and just like my other brothers. So we never used the word disabled or different or anything like that when I was growing up.
Were you a tomboy?
I was, yeah.
Oh, good, good. I figured with two brothers, you had to be a tomboy. And if you weren't treated any differently, you were out there, you know, running around, getting into trouble with dirty knees and everything, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So was there a moment that you realized that, you know, someone said something to you, someone articulated something either verbally or in a physical manner that you realize, wow, why are they treating me differently?
Well, I do have a funny story. My mom likes to tell me this. And this is the first time I ever heard the word disabled. But I was outside and there were a couple boys playing outside. So of course, you know, I have brothers. So I was trying to play outside with these two little boys, and one of them looked at me and said, "You can't play with us, you're disabled." And I put my hand on my hip and I said, "I'm not disabled," marched back into the house and asked my mom, "What does disabled mean?" And she said, "It means you can't do things that other people can do." So I went right back outside and I said, "I'm not disabled, I can do anything that you can do."
And do it better.
Yeah.
Isn't that usually what you say when you're a kid? "And I can do it better."
Probably. I don't remember that part.
So how old were you at that age?
I think that was around first grade, whatever age.
Okay,
that
so
is.
That's young.
Yeah.
So tell me about some of your other situations where and how you fared with it. I mean, it sounds like your parents raised you in a very resilient environment. When do you remember having a statement, something a bully said or did that really touched a nerve with you?
Let's see. when I was a kid, there was one guy who always called me like the worm freak.
The worm freak?
One-arm freak.
A one-arm freak. Oh, nice kid.
Yeah. So there was him, but I mean, I was such a weirdo. I just thought, oh, that's what he calls me. Like, I didn't, you know, I just still didn't. I didn't really grasp a lot of things when I was growing up. I just, like, okay, well, he's observant.
Yeah. Do you think that was sort of a defense mechanism at work?
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine your brothers didn't get wind of this because they would have probably dismembered him.
You know, I really don't know. They were really good about a lot of stuff. I don't know how they felt about it. So
and
we never had any incidences with them.
Do you remember that kid's name, first name?
I remember his first name.
What's his first name?
His first name is TC.
Casey?
TC.
Oh, TC. Well, so imagine, I'm going to speak to you, TC. Can you imagine that girl you called the one-arm freak has earned her like major features in Nordstrom, GQ, Italia, GQ Japan, Us Weekly, The Sun, newspaper, The New York Times, Glamour.com, BBC News, and of course the pinnacle of couture. Walk three seasons for Mercedes-Benz prestigious New York Fashion Week. So take that. How'd that feel? I should have had you read that. So when did you realize you wanted to be a model?
I'm sorry?
When did you realize you wanted to be a model?
When I was younger. A couple things happened. I wanted to be a model when I was young. I think a lot of girls either want to be like models or mm-hmm. actresses. So I was one of those girls. And then later when I was in, I think it was high school, I started to really see, you know, I mean, it took me until high school to really realize I was different, I guess. And to really see that there were a lot of stigmas that people with disabilities had to overcome, and I wanted to change the way people viewed disability. So I figured, you know, modeling would do that visually, so that would work. That would work in my favor to do the thing that I love to do.
That's. I applaud you on one front. At the same token, it's very daunting to say, all right, it's one thing to be in school and have some friends and also have people who ridicule you. You know, really insensitive people. But it's another to say to yourself, wow, I'm going to put myself way out there in a stratosphere where I could be susceptible to even more insult and injury. But that is a testament to your character.
Well, thank you for saying that. For me, it wasn't that much of a leap because I felt like that's what was already happening anyway. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, I'm not going to let it stop me from doing what I want to do either.
So it was high school, when you look back, an okay time, a very challenging time. I mean, hey, anybody in high school without even an obvious disability, you know, it's a tough time, you know? A lot of changes going on.
Exactly. A lot of stuff is going on. I went through a lot of different things, and, you know, I have a couple different people on my Facebook page that talk about, oh, you're so, you know, you're so inspiring, you're so confident. But I had to go through a lot of different different changes in my life to get to where I am. So, I mean, high school had its ups and downs. I had my good moments, but it was mostly challenging, you know, to figure out how to deal with certain things. And like you said, you're growing. You have your growing pains to deal with as well. So I'm sure my parents didn't love my attitude all that much. So I went through some dark times during high school.
Shahali Ayres is my guest this morning. She's an international model. Shahali, did you wear your prosthetic arm when you were that young?
When I was in high school?
Mm-hmm,
or
correct.
When I was a child?
Either.
When I was really young, I did. I wore it up until about third grade, and then I stopped wearing my prosthesis.
Because you couldn't be bothered, or are you just like, the hell with it, this is who I am?
This is who I am. It was... And I think once I was around third grade, it was, you know, people are looking at me. I wanted to be comfortable in my own skin and not feel like I had to be like everybody else. I wanted to just be myself. So I stopped wearing it.
You've written that you've had some situations that were, you know, pretty tough. Sounds like they're pretty brutal. Could you share one of those?
Without getting into too much detail.
Sure.
But I got beat up by a boy when I was a kid because of my arm. So that same, I guess the same bully, TC, he initiated a fight between this other boy and myself, where I wasn't interested in fighting at all, but I was beat up because of my arm.
A boy,
yeah.
What kind of impact did that have on you?
It definitely impacted, I think, everything. Because up until that point, I was still that little girl that was saying, you know, oh, it's okay, I just have one arm, it's okay. But at that point, I realized, well, I can get hurt because of this. This is something that people dislike so much that they're hurting me because of it. So that's when I really realized that it was an issue.
How did you deal with that, mentally and physically?
Physically, well, I think I just had to have a thicker skin. It made me grow up a lot faster. It made me less childlike in a lot of ways, and I had to start protecting myself. So at that time I started building walls, which I don't think was necessarily good, but that was my survival mechanism.
Understandable. Now, for me, not fitting in, and my disability is different. It's not an obvious one with my vision, but there's a lot of things that allowed me or prevented me to fit in the mainstream. In the long run, it really benefited me, I believe, to a certain degree. Sometimes it still does not because I never really fit in anywhere exactly because I look like, you know, an average person, but I couldn't do most of the stuff that most kids were doing back then. So did you find an outlet for yourself that made you feel like whole again, like you had a crappy day? And so Shahali would come home and do X. You'd surf, you'd work out, you'd read, you'd write in your journal, whatever. Did you have anything of that nature?
Yeah, I was really into sports. So I loved basketball. I would play basketball, and I got really involved in sports and did that. And I had a really good home life. So it was nice to come home to my family who, you know, always made me feel better. And, yeah, they were very supportive.
And I'm sure just like every girl and boy goes through, there's an actual time where a member of the opposite sex doesn't have the cooties. And you start liking boys, right? So
right.
How did that go? Maybe your first crush or was it a good experience and or your first boyfriend? Did they make you feel... something besides the fluttery, but did they make you feel like you are who you are?
I never had a hard time with boys.
Well, I wonder why. Because my producer has, by the way, my producer has your pictures up from your website, and I think it's going to be his new screensaver. Yeah, he's quite taken with you. Anyway, go ahead. I don't want to interrupt.
Okay.
it was a compliment.
Well, I don't know what else to say. I never had
that's great.
A problem.
So all through your relationships, obviously people who date you, obviously date you, it's not something you can say 6 months down the road, Shahali, there's something I need to share about you. And you're like, oh no, what are you, have you been married? Are you a child molester? But, you know, you are who you are. Like, people see your disability right away. Like, for example, I mean, there's certainly been a few women in my life when I could tell, like, I don't know whether they were more traditional and they felt like a man should always be very strong. And I don't think poor vision makes you a weaker person. Again, you just do things differently. But I could tell, certainly, you know, women I was dating casually that there was something that maybe just didn't sit all that well with them. And that was fine because I'm like, I'm not in this for the long run. We're just having, you know, to be honest with you, we're just having good sex for a couple months and we're both going to move on. That's the reality of it, you know? And there's nothing wrong with that when you're at a certain age, but you can tell. And certainly you would be more of a person who could be articulate this because somebody probably just wouldn't approach you or in that manner if they weren't comfortable with it.
Well, I think it weeded out a lot of people I wouldn't have wanted to date anyway.
True, exactly. Yeah, it just,
so
yeah,
it
that's
was,
great.
It was kind of nice. It was kind of like having some jerk radar on.
I like that.
I weeded them out before they even got here.
That's good. I think that should be the chapter, one of your chapters in your next book. How to weed out your jerk radar. My disability did that for me. So now you're in this small town, and then how did your family decide to move to Hawaii?
I moved to Hawaii by myself.
Oh, for college?
For college, yeah.
Wow. So, tell me about this decision, Shahali.
It was horrifying.
Somehow, I didn't think you were going to say that.
But it was the best. Moving to Hawaii, so after the dark time, I guess, in high school, I had to do something to get out of that situation. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really happy. I was really sad, and I knew that I had to do something to change it. So this was my opportunity to try to change that for myself. So I went to Hawaii, and thankfully it was amazing. It was, you know, it was a beautiful place to be, and it was, you know, a very accepting place. For the first time in my life, I had a lot of friends, and I was accepted, and it was really, really good.
I want to get into the Hawaii aspect and the acceptance, and I'm very happy to hear that. But before we go there, I want to find out a little bit more because I didn't get that much of a sense of your dark, dark days in high school. Did you share those dark days with anybody, your parents or a mentor or anyone?
No, I mean, I was, like I said, after I started building walls when I was a kid. So when I was in high school, I acted like I was really tough. I acted like nothing anybody said could bother me. And then I'd go home in my room and I would close the door and just cry. So I don't know. I mean, my parents might have. I think they just thought I was an angry kid. I don't think they knew that underneath it all I was, like, really upset about everything. I just tried to hide it. I was trying to cope as best I could with everything.
Well, I'm sure, you know, you don't have to be Freud to figure that out. It's pretty obvious what, you know, when people have that shell, that that perceived impenetrable shell, that it's really, you know, not really, it's a facade, it's veneer.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm happy to hear that no drugs or alcohol or nothing else came in the picture to help alleviate and or distract the true emotions.
Yeah, well, I was drinking. I was drinking at a young age.
Okay. What age?
But I think I started drinking at 16.
All right, that's pretty young.
Yeah.
More than your average 16-year-old?
Drinking?
Yes.
I'm not sure. I don't know what average, but I was drinking. I was binge drinking, like, every weekend, partying every weekend.
So moving to Hawaii, you made this decision, and I applaud you on that because, obviously, at that age, even to go to college is a huge undertaking, a whole new world, opportunity. It's great. You can reinvent yourself. I remember going to college thinking to myself, wow, this is great. No one knows who I am. The scary part is, well, they know I'm still not going to be excel academically and some other things. But why do you think, and I'm happy to hear this, but why do you think they were more accepting in Hawaii versus the mainland?
Well, I think the small town that I came from wasn't very diverse, and then I moved into Hawaii, which is, you know, it's made up of people from all different countries. So I think right off the bat, people were used to meeting people that looked different than them.
That's great. So as you're landing and you're getting settled in and signing up for college, et cetera, did you automatically feel that you made the right decision, or did it take a few months to kind of get your feet planted?
It took a few months. I remember calling home and being scared because people liked me. I was like, this must be a trick. This is a trick. This can't
really
be this bad. Yeah.
Wow.
So after 3 months, then I was fine. I was happy. And the first 2 years in Hawaii were the best years of my life. It was funny looking back and thinking, wow, it took me that long to acclimate to that.
Yeah. Well, understandable. I mean, that's a lot of years to shed, you know. That's a lot of hard times and memories to, you know, kind of let dissipate and to trust people.
Mm-hmm.
Understandable. So you studied in humanities, you got your BA, then you continued to go on to get an MBA in business administration, working in graphic design. At one point, did you say, okay, well, I'm going to go for the modeling, but you know what? I need to have a solid backup.
That was my parents. That was the voice of my parents, always in the back of my head. So as I was modeling, because when I moved to Hawaii, that's when I started to build a portfolio and stuff, and so I did both at the same time. So as I was modeling, I was also going to school.
Wow, concurrently, that's impressive. So this is very interesting that when you went into an agency, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but just tell us the shocking statement that someone told you when you walked in there.
She told me that I would never model, and no photographers would ever take pictures of me because of my arm.
Were you just aghast when you heard that someone actually said that to you versus just thinking it?
I was pretty used to it, I think, at that point. But it didn't stop it from upsetting me because this was a dream of mine.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, it was still upsetting. And at first I thought, well, then I guess this is it. I guess I got my answer. And then, you know, as I was thinking, I was like, well, people told me I couldn't play basketball. People told me I couldn't do a lot of things, and I still did it. So let's just try it anyway.
So I imagine after you were deflated for a little while, you dusted yourself off, pick yourself up, and then you did something really, really entrepreneurial. You basically funded your own shoots.
Yeah.
You're your own boss. That's great. How were your family feeling about this? Were they supportive, or were they thinking like that you were just throwing money away?
They didn't understand it for quite a few years, but they're really happy about it now. They're really excited and they're super supportive. But at first, you know, they wanted me to go to school, focus on school, and get your education. They didn't want me to, and I think too, they didn't want me to get my hopes up, you know, because at that time, this was like 10 years ago, and I mean, now we have people who with a range of disabilities who are on TV, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, no, I mean, you didn't see anybody. I barely saw people, you know, on the streets that had a disability.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Shahali.
So I think for them it was, they were just afraid that I would get hurt.
Sure,
that
of course.
The industry would, you know, hurt me, so.
So what was your ultimate goal with kind of your own expenditure of this? Did you feel that you were going to compile a good portfolio and then the world was going to be knocking on your door saying, hey, sign with us?
I guess I was hoping. And I think I was trying to do it to see if I could do it. Because it was a challenge. And as soon as someone challenges me, like, I can't back down. I had to see where it would go. I wasn't quite sure what would happen, but I had to try it out. So what was neat was without an agency, without any of that, I was able to land a few different covers in magazines. So, and that was all by myself without any representation whatsoever. So after that, I realized, okay, if I can do this.
Of course.
At 18 years old, all
That's
by myself.
Great. Good for
with
you.
With a disability. Someone can sign me.
Excellent, excellent. So do me a favor. Tell me, articulate what it's like for you to be in front of the camera. Is it like everything that you dreamed of is coming true at that moment? Do you feel like you're invincible? Do you feel completely whole? Or do you feel like you've felt like the same way all your life, but this is just something that's finally happening?
The funny thing is, in order for me to do to model, because I don't like my picture taken.
Are you kidding me?
No. So in order for me to do it, I have to like almost be like void of myself. Like I can't think I'm Shahali Ayers. I have to go into it I have to lose myself.
Interesting.
You know, and I have to, I'm like playing a character almost. I can't be myself because then that would just be weird. But I can do it when I'm pretending I'm not me.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I guess you're probably not alone in that area because I'm sure there's a lot of people who, you know, obviously actors and actresses probably do that all the time. So I guess it's not different. And, you know, it's just obviously for photography. So, you know, I was really, really blown away when you told me the first person who signed you was the person who was completely insensitive and shut you down on every level.
Yeah.
Why did you on earth choose that agency to go back in and talk to the woman who said to you, you will never model because of your arm? What, you wanted to just stick it in her face and say, here's what you're missing?
Yeah.
You are courageous.
You know I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I wanted... And it was also again to prove it to myself, mm-hmm. and to prove it to her that look, I got two magazine covers. I have this expansive portfolio. I've done all this stuff by myself. You know, here.
Wow, that's a bold move because there was one side of you that said, okay, maybe I'll sign with somebody else. I'll get a cover, and then one day I'll walk in there and not say anything and just take this magazine and drop it on her desk and say, touche.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
I applaud you for being very, very strong and courageous. So how did you decide to, obviously your ultimate goal is to change the way society perceives disability, and some great quotes you have is, I believe that which makes us different makes us beautiful. I stand strong in my objective to change the perception of disability. With your help, we can create a world that is inclusive to all. You've joined the great organization called Global Disability Inclusion, which you're basically an ambassador for. Can you tell me a little bit about that, please?
This really exciting new role. I'm brand ambassador. That just started this year. So I'm really excited to be a part of them because they do a lot of things to help people with disabilities and to create a workforce that includes people with varying disabilities. So I'm really happy to be a part of that.
And for somebody who's obviously in the workforce in many different areas, as a graphic designer, obviously you're very creative. You have great vision. Obviously, you did your own photo shoots, so you had vision for settings, et cetera, and how things would be applied for pictures. And it's great to obviously a vision to execute the vision that you've had for your entire life to change the perception of people with disabilities. And that's just amazing, Shahali. And by the way, I want to tell people your name, Shahali, derives from, is it a stream or a creek in Oregon?
It's a waterfall.
Waterfall, even beautiful. Oh, there's a lot of strength in waterfalls. There you go. So to also tell me about your ultimate goal. What is your ultimate goal?
My ultimate goal would be to take on modeling full-time and to do it as a full-time career and be like the next Kate Moss of modeling because I think it's important. Right now, we like I said before, we don't have too many people out there in the industry, whether movies, TV, print, that have a disability, at least not as far as I'm aware of. So I think it'd be very powerful to have somebody who, does have a disability
and
out there. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm just saying I think it would be really great to have somebody out there that has one and that is proving, I can do this regardless.
Sure. And it also wouldn't hurt on the way if you landed the cover of Vogue.
Yeah, it wouldn't hurt.
So listen, in preparing for this interview, I realized a former girlfriend of mine, you linked up with her, Christine Brinkley. Don't
former girlfriend of yours.
Yeah, just don't Google it, okay?
Okay.
Here's a quote. Shahali is gorgeous in her eyes. I see her looking at a very bright and exciting future. Listen, everybody has something they feel self-conscious about or limited by at some time or another. Or maybe it's something that makes them feel different, that makes them feel that they don't fit in. It's how you deal with that challenge that ultimately set you in a part. And it goes on to say many complimentary things about you, Shahali. And I imagine, obviously, from someone of this caliber, international icon, married to a former husband, international icon, that must have sent you just completely, completely ecstatic.
Yeah, I still can't believe it. And this was a couple years ago, so it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, I want to commend you on a fine job. Your tenacity, you're willing to be to put it all out there, your perseverance, your resiliency. And, of course, you have to promise me one thing before I keep complimenting you. When you're here in New York City, the Big Apple, in the fall for the Fashion Week, Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week, you have to come up here for a proper interview.
I would love to.
Awesome. And so we should tell people your website is shahaliayers.com. That's Shahaliayers. All the best to you. Congratulations. You are a force to be reckoned with, my friend.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show.
And very quickly, last time I was in Hawaii, after I had a few drinks, instead of saying mahalo, I said maloha to somebody. I'm proud of myself. I said this on national radio. Yes. So aloha, my dear. Thank you for your time.
Aloha.
This has been Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. This show and all podcasts are on PRN.FM, PRN.FM. If you'd like to have me speak at your school, corporation, or organization, please check my website, markfarrellmotivation.com, markfarrellmotivation.com. Have a great day.